Good morning. It's the KPCW Local News Hour. I'm Carolyn Murray sitting in for Leslie Thatcher. This morning, our first guest is Doug Clyde. He is the Summit County Council member who is joining us here in the studio to give us an update on all things county business. From last night's meeting, let's start off. Welcome, first of all.
Thank you for coming in.
Let's start off talking about the Bittner Road discussion. Rick has reported that there were something like 100 people there last night to sort of weigh in or give input.
It was a full house, to be sure. We were actually happy about that. We worked hard at getting the word out to all the citizens in the area. We made over, I believe, 1,500 mailings so that people knew that there was that this road was in the offering. What we looked at last night were four different optional alignments that all had their pluses and minuses. The somewhat new information last night was we had previously been assured by the Woodside home developers that everybody in Woodside knew that there was a potential for a frontage road in between them and the highway. And of course, as those things often play out, most of the residents were unaware of that. So that's a complication. There was also another alternative that was offered by one of the landowners of a different alignment. So there's now a fifth alignment that we might be considering. And I think what we concluded after hearing all the public input was that we needed to go back and study it in more detail.
Okay. Is there an option that you're leaning toward yourself?
Well, I think no, I don't think there is. It's just a very complex issue where we're trying to minimize impacts on existing homes, yet at the same time provide safe emergency access.
And who brought the fifth option last night?
That was the Bittner Ranch owners themselves.
I see. And then there are some people who think that Silver Creek doesn't need another road. What's your opinion there?
Well, I think those people, I certainly appreciate their opinion. And but, you know, it's clear when you talk to the first responders, such as the fire and ambulance people, that their access to the Silver Creek area is very long, very slow. And that, of course, is one of our responsibilities, is to make sure that we're providing sufficient access for emergency providers.
I see. Okay, let's talk about transit sales taxes. Do you favor implementing these, Doug?
Again, this is really double-edged. This was something that was teed up by the legislature late in the session that provided the counties an option to implement more tax for transit and transportation. It's a very complicated deal. Oddly enough, the legislature is allowing us to do it without public approval. The last transit tax that we had, we did that with voter approval. This is an opportunity that appears to be A, somewhat ephemeral, and B, does not require voter approval. That makes us extremely uncomfortable because, of course, we just went through an effort to raise taxes for traffic and transit, but went through a very large public outreach campaign so that everybody knew what they were getting involved in. That said, Public Works Department is pretty clear that that even with the taxes that we've imposed, there isn't enough money to come close to fulfilling all the goals and objectives that we have with our transit plan.
So what was it initially that brought the legislature to the place where they were ready to put this in place and not seek voter input?
I don't know that I can speak authoritatively on that, but my understanding is that it has to do primarily with Salt Lake City and Salt Lake County, that was the stimulus for getting this done. And because I believe it was Salt Lake County voters had rejected a tax increase, and so the legislature enabled them to add a tax increase without voter approval. And so I believe that's why we're in this state. We're trying to get as much word out to the public as possible that this thing is pending so that we can get feedback. That's a place where we feel sorely disadvantaged, of course, because we have a very short time period in which to pull the trigger on this.
Sure. So if we don't set this up, if we choose not to proceed, will the state go ahead and move forward with it, and then they decide how to spend the money?
Some of the money ends up going to the state, regardless. If we do set it up, there's a cost sharing formula in there. But no, I think the answer to your question is no. They won't impose it on the county itself. It's a self-imposed tax, and primarily for the benefit of the county. And one of the reasons why operating on it quickly is important is that we will receive substantially more funds that are proprietary to the county's project than if we wait on it. The other thing, of course, is if we wait on it, there is some likelihood that after Salt Lake and Salt Lake County get their situation resolved, that the legislature will have it go away. So it could be a very ephemeral opportunity.
Yeah, is it too soon after having just passed in 2016 the two levies for transit and transportation?
Well, I think that's the entire concern, is that we couldn't see this coming. Obviously, this was not the sort of thing that the legislature normally does. And we had just gone out to the voters and through a very large and public campaign received significant support for traffic and transit taxes. And we were very pleased about that. We just know that it's not enough money to get everything done that we want to get done.
So. Okay. And so this, we're sort of belaboring this, but what are we talking about in terms of a dollar figure if we were to do this?
you mean in revenue to the county? it's like in the neighborhood of $4 to $5 million a year potentially. So it's a significant chunk of money that changes over time. Again, with the split, it'll change. It'll change depending upon whether Salt Lake County and the city get involved in it as well. If they don't pull the trigger on it, it may be less advantageous to us. So, again, it's rather complicated.
Yeah, sure is. So let's talk about personnel changes. The county has announced it's released the general manager of Mountain Regional District, Andy Armstrong, and Melissa O'Brien from Snyderville Rec will be interim manager. Andy's contract was set to expire in September anyway. What's happening here?
Well, you've touched upon a personnel matter, and there's limited, if anything, I can say about personnel matters in public. We did put out a press release indicating what had happened there, and that's really about all we can say, is there's been a change of management.
Okay. And so will you be proceeding with finding a new manager?
Absolutely, yeah.
And that's happening right away?
That's happening right now. And okay. Melissa O'Brien happens to be a person of considerable depth and breadth in her background. She's a lawyer by training. She has some background in public utilities. So we're confident of her as an interim manager and glad to have her able to step in and take over.
Okay, great. So also in animal control, the director, Clay Coleman, he is being moved over to as a purchasing agent. The supervisor at animal control, Stacy Gunn, will be the interim director. Mm-hmm. Will she work into the permanent director position for that?
I believe that is a possibility, although that hasn't been decided yet. The struggle with the county and budgeting is always, we want to be responsive, we want to do everything we can, but at the same time we have to watch out for the number of full-time year-round employees that we have and make sure that our budget is tight. So every time somebody comes in with a change like this, the juggling act that they go through is to say, see, the number of full-time employees hasn't changed. So that's why she is interim right now, and we'll just have to see how that works out.
So is there a possibility you won't replace the director position?
I really don't know at this point.
Okay.
We have the same amount of staffing that we had pre-recession in animal control, or perhaps one more full-time employee than we previously did. And so I think people should look at that as being a positive move, that we're continuing to look at that as a priority.
Okay. And then a perennial problem came back to the council. A number of Sunpeak residents have been very passionate about passionate about a crossing or an underpass or an overpass near the Blue Roof intersection of Highway 224, feeling that it's quite a dangerous location for children who would be crossing to Parley's Park Elementary, which is just right across on Silver Springs Drive. And a project has not gotten off the ground at this point, but there's been a lot of discussion over the last several years. Last night, resident Erin Ruzak asked about it, and she says that when the 2014 rec bond passed, they were promised that this would happen. However, a couple of council members, Kim Carson and Roger Armstrong, they don't really remember it that way. What is your take on this, Doug?
Well, of course, first of all, it predates me, unfortunately. But I did look at the research that Roger did. It was quite extensive, and I would have to agree with Roger that there was no there were no definites in what was proposed to be covered in that bond. There were a lot of options. We at the time, the council left it open to their discretion to choose which were the more appropriate options. And one of the reasons why you do that is because when you enter into these design phases on these projects, you only have an approximation of what things will cost, right? So when we go back and we look at that crossing, it seemed like a good idea at the time, thought we could get it done for about $2 million. The last figure that came in was north of $4 million and probably has some acute engineering challenges. The other thing is that, we have looked at that intersection with UDOT and gone out on the ground. I use we in the royal sense, that was the previous council, and said, look, is this a dangerous intersection? Is there anything else you can do for us? Can you put flashing lights on here? Can you put, raised walkways, anything of that nature? And what UDOT tells us is that, as far as intersections go, it's a very safe intersection. There's a lot of traffic on the road. That's the concern. So we're looking at that option as well as options nearby. We may or may not have pulled the trigger on that. But, out of a $20 million bond, for example, or $25 million bond, a $4 or $5 million hit for trails is a big chunk. So we've got to make sure that it has good utility.
Yeah, it's interesting. They would suggest that that's not a dangerous intersection. My anecdotal experience is that there are a lot of crashes at that intersection.
The nature of talking traffic speak is always complicated for the average person, because there are books and rules and engineering standards that have been proven over time and throughout the nation that these people rely on. So frequently when you ask a traffic engineer whether something's a problem, they say, no, it's not a problem. If you have two drivers going in the same direction on one road, there's a good chance one of them feels that there's a traffic problem. Either they're going too fast or too slow. And 224, of course, just has major traffic, and we're trying our best to reduce that. That's what our transportation initiatives are all about.
Well, the speeds change. You've got ingress and egress. You have neighborhoods, commercial. It's a bit of a nightmare.
the whole length of it. And we're also trying to implement a bus rapid transit lane in there at the same time. And so until we get all of our plans put together on 224, until we know what the entire geometry of that road looks like, by which I mean, are there bus lanes? Are there new turnouts? How wide are the intersections going to be? Are we going to change any of that geometry? We won't be able to come to a hard conclusion on where or if that's a desirable crossing.
So is there a timeline that you think will be addressing
this?
Yeah,
we thought we would be through with our transportation plan later in this year. So.
Okay, great. Well, I think we have to leave it there. Thank you very much, Doug, for coming in. Well, this is the Local News Hour. Good morning. We have our next guest, Chris Herod. He is one of two candidates running in the Republican primary for U.S. Congress District 1, District 3, excuse me. The election is June 26th, and he previously held a seat in the Utah House District 62 from 2007 to 2013. Welcome, Chris.
Thank you very much for having me on today.
So, Chris, you're challenging John Curtis, who was elected in a special election last year. Jason Chaffetz left office early, and a special election was held. District 3 includes Utah County, and it covers into the southeastern portion of the state to the Four Corners area. And registered Republicans in Wasatch County, which is part of our listening area, will be voting in June's primary. Welcome. Thanks for coming. So let's first talk about last year's special election, where former Provo Mayor John Curtis won the primary election held in August. He took 43% of the Republican votes in that election. You came in with 32%, and Tanner Ainge came in with 24%. So it was a three-way primary. So you won, though, the Republican convention, defeating 11 candidates.
I did.
Last year. But you were pretty soundly defeated in the general election. So is this whole system an indication that the current caucus convention system used in Utah is not necessarily representative?
Well, when you look at the fact, Tanner Ainge actually ran as a conservative. And so I, there's no question that I'm conservative. And so Tanner Ainge and I split the conservative voice. And so if you add, mine and Tanner's, it adds up to more than 50%. And so that's one of the reasons I got back in the race. I hadn't planned on running, but when I saw that no conservative had signed up to take on John, and then I saw that there was only one person that had signature gathering, because I didn't want to be in another three-way race. But when I saw that happen on the last day, then I decided to jump in again.
I see. So House Bill 54... here in Utah, it basically upholds the whole signature gathering process as being a valid way to get on the ballot. What are your thoughts on that compared with the caucus convention system? Do you have an opinion there?
Oh, I do. I actually went up to the legislature and actually spoke against SB 54. And for me, I spoke against it on constitutional grounds, because for me, you look at the First Amendment, and there's two great rights. I think that you have religious rights, and then you have political rights. And the right to associate is one of those great political rights that you have. And, I also saw other types of association rights and even religious rights that could be infringed. You could argue in this state that the LDS Church has a great amount of influence, even on politics. And so, should the public have a right in how the LDS Church chooses its leaders? I think most people would say that that's pretty far-fetched, but that's the same thing that's happened with political organizations. And if you read the dissenting opinion of the Chief Justice of the 10th Circuit, he wrote a dissenting view, because it was upheld 2-1 in the 10th Circuit, but he wrote a dissenting view that was as long as the opinion. And he expressed, I would encourage everybody to read that this could have long-term religious and all sorts of association rights.
You mean allowing people to use signature gathering as a method to get on the ballot?
Yeah, just allowing government to be able to tell a private organization how they choose their leaders, And to me, I protect that First Amendment right. I like to think that people should always get together. But if an organization wants to get together and, whether you're pro-choice or pro-life, but I don't think the government should be able to tell the pro-choice organization how they have to choose their leaders, just like I don't think that the government should have the right of the pro-life to choose their leaders. And so for me, that's the constitutional issue involved in this.
Okay. Let's move on to a discussion about fiscal responsibility. It's pretty common for Republican agendas to talk about fiscal practices, and we have had a little bit of hypocrisy, some would say, in Washington in recent months when the most recent tax break was put in place. There was a tax bill that some have been projecting will increase the deficit by about $1 trillion by 2020. That's just a couple years down the road. What are your thoughts on that? And would you have voted for that?
Yeah, I would have voted for that. Just for, the problem that I see with that is they use a static model. They don't take in the amount of growth. And the problem is we have the fourth highest corporate rate in the world. And so when that happens, companies that are looking to invest go to other places that have a much lower. Now, with that tax cut, we're not the lowest, but we're right in the middle, and we're at least competitive. I believe in the end that, that overall that's the same thing that happened with the Reagan cuts. That was a big concern that we would increase the deficit. But the government actually got more money in after the Reagan cuts. Now, the issue is if we don't address our spending issues, we will have problems. I mean, it doesn't matter what you do with that. We have to address those issues. And that's one of the things that I'm running on is I do believe that our national debt is one of the greatest national security issues that we have. I've lived through hyperinflation. When I was teaching in the Ukraine, there was dramatic inflation, and hyperinflation punishes all those people that did everything right, that lived frugally, that lived within their means, saved money, and then overnight you can have that happen. And that's what will happen to the United States. Once we lose, once we're no longer the world's reserve currency, then we just can't borrow and print more money, and we'll end up being like Greece. And so for me, we have to address those issues.
So you think the tax cuts are a good thing ultimately, but you think spending, what are there particular programs that you feel are excessive or unneeded and would be a better thing to eliminate?
Yeah, for example, the U.S. Constitution, I look at it, I'm a constitutionalist, and if it's not in Article 1, Section 8 of the U.S. Constitution, the federal government shouldn't be doing. I see no purpose for the Department of Education. I think the states can do it best. There's a budget that you can cut rather easily. Just because I trust the people of Utah to determine how to best educate our children. But we have to be honest that if we don't address entitlement spending, that's where the real problem that we have. We have to make cuts to Social Security. Now, I'm 52. If you tell me that I'm going to have to work a year longer or I'm going to get 10% less right now, I can make an adjustment. I believe that we need to leave those that are currently on Social Security or are going to retire in the next few years. You leave them alone. But somebody like me, you tell me I'm going to work another year, but I have time to plan. But the problem you have is the longer you wait to make those cuts, those difficult cuts, the more drastic those cuts have to be. And so I think we need to have some courage. And the problem is, Social Security has always been the third rail of politics. But again, for me, I bring a practical experience because I would much rather have the pain of cutting now than having the market, punish everybody. Because the most hurt by hyperinflation are actually seniors because they see their life savings evaporate. And yet they're lost their earning capacity. And so I think it's much more compassionate that we address it now. And I've had the courage in the past to do this, to make those difficult choices.
Okay. So let's talk about the monument status of the Bears Ears. It's obviously a significant section of this district that we're talking about. Have you held any town halls down there to sort of tap into what people are trying to achieve there? And what is your level of support for the policies right now in place as far as reducing or eliminating national monuments? Where do you stand on that?
Yeah, last time around, I was happy to be endorsed by both San Juan County commissioners. This time, Phil Lyman is endorsing me. This is not a new issue. I like to say when I was in the Utah legislature that I was the first Wasatch Front legislator that fully understand what was happening to rural Utah. And I believe the oppression of the federal government. And it's been done by lots of ways, from the BLM, from over regulation. And so I do support President Trump in his reduction of Bears Ears and Grand Staircase National Monument. I don't think that's the proper way to do it. I think the Antiquities Act needs to be repealed. It was never meant for a president to have the type of power to be able to take 2 million acres or 1 million acres. It was originally meant for 50 acres, 5,000 acres as something immediately to be done and damaged. And so I think it needs to be just because rural Utah, it's tough to make a living. And I want them to be able to provide for their families. You look at cities like Kanab. Kanab used to could send their kids off to college, and then they could get an engineering degree and come back and work in the mines, or a forestry degree and come back and work in the forests. Now, you only have tourism jobs, which, it's great if you own the hotel or the restaurant, but then the only other type of jobs are a maid or a waiter. Now, I was a waiter for 5 years or 7 years of my life. It was a great job for college, but I didn't go to college for that. And so, you know, I'm a big believer in multi-use. I trust the people of Utah that we will do so in a responsible area. I love the high UNAs. But I also love to drive, you know, ride my motorcycle. And so let the people of Utah decide how to best use our natural resources.
So what about the Indian tribes then? They're concerned that these are sacred areas, and culturally they're very precious to them. And have you sought input from them? And
you know, I've had brief conversations with that, and I do think those areas need to be protected. I just don't think you need to do it in such a large, you know, a million acres or 800 million acres. You can do it much better. It's already a crime to desecrate those things, and those crimes need to be prosecuted. And so, you know, that's how you protect it. But I don't think you need a million acres, because it's just locking up natural resources.
Okay. Jason Chaffetz was involved in the Central Wasatch Recreation Area Conservation Project, and he introduced a bill in 2016, House Bill 5718, that would preserve the Granger Peak Mount Air Wilderness. It would designate about 80,000 acres of federal land in the Wasatch Cache National Forest as a conservation recreation area. What are your thoughts on this? What are your views about making a small section of wilderness area in the Central Wasatch?
You know, that's a much more reasonable number, the 80,000 acres. And I, you know, I'll admit that's a bill that I don't know as much about as, you know, so before I give a final opinion, but something like that that has local support, and you know, but that's a much more reasonable number than that. But I would have to see the language before I would make a final decision. But to me, that's much more reasonable and something I would look at. Like I said, I love the high UNAs. I grew up backpacking there, fishing with my scout troop, and so I believe that there's a place for those.
Okay, let's talk about immigration in the news this week. In the last couple of weeks, there are children that are being taken from their parents at U.S. borders. Do you think that should happen?
You know, I mean, that's been, if it's current law, the law needs to be followed. You know, the problem that we have with immigration, and this is something that I know quite a bit. I was actually married in the Ukraine. I've experienced the immigration process from start to finish. My sister-in-law is from South Korea, and I have two adopted nieces from China, and my business partner is a black Ethiopian Jew that my family sponsored. So I believe in immigration. But we have to get over this notion that tolerating illegal immigration is compassionate. It is not compassionate for us to encourage people to come to our border with their children, because if you look what happens on the border, there's the rape trees. Many of these individuals end up in human trafficking, and so we have to do something. Now, you know, the best way to solve the problem is to quit having it happen and letting people know, don't risk bringing your child across the desert, because we'll immediately send you home, or send you home rather quickly. And so, you know, I would prefer that the mother and the child get sent home together. And it, you know, we need more immigration judges and things so that happens, but we cannot continue to tolerate. First off, it's not fair. I've been outside the embassies in both the U.S. embassies in Kiev and Moscow, and I've seen parents in tears when they were denied visa. Most people don't realize the standard of living in Ukraine, where my wife is from, is half that of Mexico. And my friend from Ethiopia, the GDP per capita is 1/15 of Mexico, and life expectancy is 20 years less.
Well, let me ask this. How do you propose fixing this problem, then, if you were in Congress?
You know, one of the ways is you know, if we need more immigration judges to prevent that. I also do pollute. I do support President Trump. I mean, I've been to the border where it's a single strand of barbed wire. That encourages people to come. And, you know, the problem I have is that it's not just, if you can smuggle humans, then you can smuggle dirty bombs, suitcase nuclear weapons, all sorts of drugs. You look at the opioid crisis, the vast majority of those, the opioids are coming from Mexico. And so we have to realize that it's a national security. You know, I'm a big believer in immigration, but our current policy right now is actually racist, because if you look at it, when one nation, which makes up less than 2% of the world's population, gets 28% of the benefit of legal immigration, 50% of the benefit of illegal immigration, and 79% of the benefit of DACA students, That's the very very definition of institutional racism. We're discriminating against the African, against Asians are the most discriminated against. And so we have to, again, we have to get over this notion that our current toleration of illegal immigration is fair to people around the world.
Okay. We're going to have to leave it there. Thank you for coming in, Chris Herod. Chris is the one of two Republican primary candidates running for the District 3 U.S. Congress position election day, primary election day, June 26th.
That's
so
great.
Please get out and vote.
Well, thank you very much. Go to herodforcongress.com if you have any questions. So thank you for having me on.
Thank you very much, Chris. Our next guest on the Local News Hour is Kate McChesney. She's the executive director for the PC, Park City, Silly Market, Silly Sunday Market. We're kicking off the season this Sunday, and it sounds like there are a few changes. Welcome. Thank you for coming in.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for having us.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, give us a little rundown about some of the things that are going to be different this year with the market, and we can let people know what to expect.
Right. Well, I mean, it'll always feel and look the same. Because, of course, our footprint never changes. We have our farmers market up here at the post office lot, as well as when you go down the street from, you know, the former Kimball all the way down to the circle, it'll all look and feel the same. But we've got about 40% new vendors this year, so we're really excited about that. We cut back on a lot of the vendors that would commit to 14 Sundays so we could really be unique every week. And then as far as food goes, we've got crepes coming in. We've got some gyros coming in because there's no good Greek food or any Greek food in Park City. For our bar, we're going to be doing frozen cocktails this year. For our zero waste, we're doing a strawless campaign. So for all of our cocktails, you'll either get a piece of licorice for your straw or you'll get a piece of pasta for your straw. So we're doing something, and all of those actually, you know, at the end of the day with our zero waste, they can go into our compost and feed our pigs out in Camas.
Yeah, maybe you should find one of those vendors that sell those beautiful glass straws and set them up right next to you. Is it too late for that?
Yeah, we're sold out.
Sorry about that.
That's okay.
Okay, let's talk
But yes, there's always someone who, you know, commented as soon as we said we were strawless, they started sending us all of these interesting types of straws, and as far as we're concerned, we're going to go pasta and red vine licorice.
Okay, didn't mean to be one of those
no,
yahoos weighing in on how you ought to do the silly market.
No, not at all.
Okay, so, Kate, tell us about parking in China Bridge. It's a little bit different this year, is it not?
Correct. I mean, as you know, we have no control over the parking. That's Park City Municipal, but all the lots are going to be really monitored from 7 a.m. all the way till 5. There will be a $5 minimum. $5 per hour with a maximum of $18. So ultimately, if you're coming to the street for more than a few hours, it really is worth it for you just to pay the parking and you know, give it to the city. Otherwise, we pay to have use of the parking lot at the high school. And then from the high school, you can just take the bus, and that runs every 10 minutes. But truthfully, don't drive. Just bike or bus or hike or walk. That's what the rest of us have to do, and we really want to encourage that. That's really part of our initiative and sustainability is to just bus, bike, walk, or hike. And we do have a free bike valet, and that's at the bottom of the street down on 9th Avenue. Totally free, secure parking for your $3,000 Park City mountain bike, which we encourage mostly. So,
absolutely. Yeah. So it's not you're not holding it every weekend this year. There are three weekends in, is it August?
Correct. So we still have our 14 dates, which is super important for us. So we'll kick off on June 3rd. We'll go all the way through September 23rd. And then the three first weeks of August, so August 5th, 12th, and the 19th, we will not be hosting a market, which actually works out really well for us because we program the Summit County Fair. So those weeks, we're not necessarily off either. But we're out in Colville doing some fun stuff out there, and then we let the street be programmed by the other events.
Okay, good. Yeah. So what about the neighbors? It, like any event in Park City, there's always a mixed bag. There's event fatigue, that kind of thing. Some people really love the market, and some say it disrupts their quality of life. What's the organization doing to outreach to those folks who are frustrated with how it affects their being able to get in and out of their driveways and all of that kind of thing?
So we actually put signage up every Sunday so that the residential parking on Park Ave and above is really for the residents. As far as event fatigue, if that's the case and we just committed to, 83 more days in Park City. You know, I have a hard one with that. We're only 14 Sundays. We've been here. This is our 12th season. And so, you know, but we're out there. We go to all the SEAC meetings. We go to the Main Street Alliance meetings. We go to council. We're in front of everybody. We have, you know, choices to be heard. We've made sure that all the decibels in the band, and we're, you know, against, we commit to code. So really, you know, we're doing what we can, and we're all about code. We have the fire marshal comes with us on the street every Sunday. We have a Park City municipal employee with us on the street every Sunday. And so we know that we're doing what we can. And as far as parking, we give the opportunity. I mean, every piece of marketing that goes out, we tell people not to park, and we put out signs. We also go door to door with the city, and that is door to door for every single event. So all of the residents of Lower Old Town know exactly what's coming.
Okay.
Yeah.
So the press release that I saw this morning says, be ready for some surprises on this 12th anniversary of the season. Are you ready to tell us about any of those surprises?
Wow, I wonder what they are. I think it's just really the vibe. It's just a continually awesome vibe. We're going to have two pet adoptions this year. Last year we had a pet adoption on our last day, and that worked out really well. I think we had 17 or 18 dogs and cats adopted. So we'll be doing that as well September 23rd, but we're also going to do that on June 10th, our second weekend. And then I think really it's just about the frozen cocktails. Pretty sure we're going to be the only bar and pop-up at that that's going to be offering frozen cocktails on Main Street. So that's kind of a surprise. And then as well, just all the new vendors. There's a lot of times when I ask someone why they haven't come to Park City, it's because they continually say it's the same old, same old. Really, if you come and walk the street, it's not the same old, same old. Again, the look is there, the feel is there, but the vendors are all totally different, all unique. You know, we think we have four importers and the rest are all artists and designers. So, and local artists and designers. So we're really excited about that.
Great. What about live performance? What do you have in mind?
So we have the main stage. That'll kick off at 10 a.m. every morning all the way till 5. That'll have soft music. Normally we have Chad and Christo, and then a larger band at 11. Performers this particular weekend, we're going to kick off with the Ann West Belly Dancers. They're really fun ladies. And then in the afternoon, we have a bigger band coming on, and those bands normally go from 3 to 5. And at the farmer's market, the bands as well kick off at 10 a.m. We have 2 to 3 bands that'll happen up there. I think we have the Brothers this weekend, as well as Teresa happening at the farmer's market. And then our biggest is really the buskers that come. So just the kids on the street banging on the bucket drums. We have another boy who plays the violin and viola. We launched his little career. He's 12 years old. He's now got a full scholarship to a music program this coming summer, and we're really excited about them. So it's just, you know, we've got stilt walkers, face painters, clowns, balloon artists. We've got magicians, didgeridoos, all these. It's crazy. It's fun. It's amazing. And I love it. I wouldn't, you know, one of the mottos that I always say and my team always says is we couldn't imagine ourselves anywhere else on a Sunday. So it's
well,
nice.
Thank you, Kate McChesney.
Thank you.
Kate McChesney, Executive Director for the Park Silly Sunday Market.
It's a mouthful.
It's a mouthful. Thank you for coming in.
Thanks. See you Sunday.
Bye now.